Okay, so Daniel 8, huh? It's pretty wild stuff, right? Visions and prophecies and all this symbolic imagery. Like, where do you even begin?
Yeah, it can be overwhelming, that's for sure.
Well, that's why we're here. We're going to try to, unpack it all. And we've got a great guide for this deep dive. We're looking at a lecture by Dr. Wendy Winter.
Oh, yeah, she's great. Really insightful.
Yeah, she calls Daniel 8 God's leash on evil. I mean, how's that for an attention grabber?
It definitely makes you think, right? Like, even in the midst of all this chaos and suffering, there's some kind of control, some limit to how far evil can go.
Yeah, like a glimmer of hope, right? But okay, before we get too deep into that whole leash concept, let's back up a bit. We're jumping back into Hebrew here, right? After that whole section in Aramaic, what's the significance of that?
Right, good catch. It's more than just a language change. It signals a return to the book's original language,
Okay.
and I think it points to a bigger shift in focus. See, chapters 2 through 7, those were all about the exile experience, the immediate crisis facing the Jewish people.
Right.
But now in chapters 8 through 12, we're dealing with visions that have a much longer view. It's about the restored land of Israel. It's about the future.
So it's less about like the immediate what now and more about like what's next.
Exactly. And as we move through these chapters, the scope of Daniel's visions actually narrows. Chapter 7, remember, it was cosmic in scale. Four beasts, the Ancient of Days. It was a lot to take in.
Yeah, I remember that.
But now in 8, 9, and then 10 through 12, the focus is really honing in on the Second Temple period, specifically the events surrounding its desecration by, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes.
Oh, yeah, that guy. Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Just the name sends chills down your spine. I mean, to really understand what Daniel's seeing here, we've got to get a handle on the historical context, right?
Absolutely.
Like, where does this guy fit into the big picture?
Okay, so think of it this way. After the Babylonian exile, Cyrus's decree allowed the Jews to return to their land, rebuild the temple. But during the Second Temple period, their land, Palestine, as it was often called, became like this battleground between two powerful empires, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies.
So Israel's stuck in the middle of this power struggle.
Exactly. And this is where Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes enters the scene. He's a Seleucid ruler, and in 167 BC, he does some truly horrific things, like desecrating the temple, for example. It's hard to even imagine the trauma.
Yeah, it's with this historical backdrop in mind that Daniel receives the visions in chapter 8. Now, Dr. Witter breaks the chapter down into three distinct vision blocks. Each block has several individual visions within it.
Right, and that structure is super helpful because it helps us, make sense of what can feel like a jumble of confusing images. Think of it like, I don't know, like a three-act play, each act building upon the last, leading to a climax.
Okay, I like that. A three-act play. So let's jump into Act One, shall we? The vision of the two-horned ram. What's the deal with this ram?
Well, later on, Gabriel's going to come in and tell us straight up that this ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire.
Oh, okay.
And, it's charging westward, northward, southward, all this aggressive activity. It really symbolizes the empire's, expansion, dominance. There's actually something interesting about this image, something you might miss at first glance.
What's that?
There's no Babylon, like, at all, even though at this time, Daniel is in Babylon.
That is interesting. If this is about empires that are going to impact Israel's future, you'd think Babylon would be front and center.
Right. Well, Dr. Witter suggests it's because by this point, Babylon's kind of a has-been. The focus has shifted to these new empires that are going to directly shape Israel's destiny. Empires like, well, like Medo-Persia, obviously. And as we'll see in the next vision block, Greece.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. So we got the ram, Medo-Persia. Now on to Act Two, which features, well, a much more dynamic creature, a one-horned goat. This thing is flying across the earth. I mean, the imagery is wild.
Yeah, it is. And this goat, as Gabriel's going to tell us later, represents Greece, specifically Alexander the Great.
Oh, wow.
And that image of it flying across the earth, that's Alexander conquering the Persian Empire with lightning speed.
Like a whirlwind.
Exactly. But then things take a dark turn.
Uh-oh.
The goat's horn, it breaks,
Oh, no.
and four horns emerge in its place.
Four horns. What do those represent?
Hold on, it gets even weirder. Then this little horn
A
appears.
little horn.
Yeah, okay, so the four horns, those are Alexander's successors, the generals who divided up his empire after he died.
Okay, makes sense.
But the little horn, that's where things get really interesting, and interpretations, they differ. But a lot of scholars believe it refers to Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes.
The same guy who desecrated the temple.
Yep, that's him. And his actions are described in some pretty disturbing detail here. He takes away the daily sacrifices, desecrates the sanctuary, throws truth to the ground. It's like a picture of total spiritual devastation. But then, right in the middle of all this darkness, we get this incredibly moving scene.
What's that?
A dialogue between the Holy Ones.
Oh, wow.
And they ask this question that, honestly, I think anyone who's ever faced suffering can relate to. How long?
Yeah, how long?
Right? Like, when you're facing pain and injustice, you just want to know, when will it end? How much longer do I have to endure this?
Yeah, for real.
And the answer they get is 2,300 evenings and mornings.
Okay, but what does that even mean?
That's where things get a little tricky. There are a few different interpretations. One possibility is that it refers to the number of daily sacrifices.
Okay.
Which would be a little over 3 years.
Interesting.
And, you know, that's actually pretty close to the time, times, and half a time mentioned in Chapter 7, another symbolic time frame for tribulation.
Oh, wow. So there's a connection there.
Exactly. Like, maybe there's a deeper meaning here, a pattern to these periods of intense suffering. But another possibility is that each evening and morning represents a literal day. So we're talking about, like, 6 years and 4 months, almost a full 7 years.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
It is. And seven, you know, that's a super significant number in biblical symbolism, often represents completion.
So, like, until the time of completion, the suffering continues.
Could be. But there's a third option, too. And this is the one Dr. Witter really emphasizes in her lecture, the idea that the number is symbolic, like not meant to be taken literally.
Okay.
It represents an appointed time of the end. Less about calculating a specific time frame and more about the assurance that the suffering will eventually cease.
Okay, so we've got three different ways of understanding that time frame. Each one adds another layer of complexity to the vision.
Yeah, but don't worry, we're going to get some answers soon, because in Act 3, Gabriel shows up to interpret the whole thing for Daniel.
Oh, good.
And this isn't just any angel, you know. This is Gabriel, one of only two named angels in the entire Bible.
Wow, okay.
The other one being Michael.
Right, right.
So that adds a lot of weight to his interpretation, right?
Definitely.
So he confirms that the ram is Medo-Persia, the goat is Greece, the great horn is Alexander.
Okay, but what about that mysterious little horn? Does Gabriel spill the beans on who that is?
He does, but there's still some ambiguity. He describes him as having, power shall be great, but not by his own power.
Whoa, what does that even mean? Not by his own power.
Yeah, it makes you think, right? Like, this little horn, he's clearly a destructive force, but he's also, like, being manipulated, empowered by something even greater than himself.
It's kind of creepy when you think about it that way. Like, is evil just a tool?
It's a chilling thought that even the most wicked figures might just be playing a role in a larger cosmic drama that they don't even fully understand.
It raises a lot of questions, like, who or what is empowering him and why?
Right. It almost suggests that even the worst evil, it's ultimately under God's control, even if we don't get the reasons why. It's a lot to ponder. Yeah. It really does make you wonder about free will, huh? Like, if even someone as bad as this little horn guy is ultimately a tool in God's hand, I mean, does that mean we even have a choice?
It's a deep question, for sure. One that people have been debating for, like, ever. But getting back to this little horn, Gabriel describes him as, like, fierce of face, understands riddles, and makes deceit prosper. It's like he's a master manipulator.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, he's taking wisdom, twisting it, you know, using it for evil.
And that's what makes him so different from the ram and the goat, right? I mean, they were destructive, sure, but it was like a natural kind of power, just empires doing what empires do, rising and falling. But the little horn, his power is explicitly not by his own power. That's scary.
Right. It's like he's a puppet being used by something way bigger than himself.
So is he like a willing participant in this evil? Or is he, like you said, just a pawn?
I don't know. It's unsettling either way. But even more disturbing, he's winning. Like, he's destroying mighty men, even the people who are the saints, as Gabriel puts it.
It's hard to read that and not feel dismerged, right? Like, sometimes it seems like evil just wins.
Yeah. And that brings us back to why Gabriel calls this the vision of the evenings and the mornings. It's not the vision of the ram or the goat, right? It's the vision of the time frame, that 2,300 evening and mornings of suffering.
So it's not so much about the empires themselves, but more about what happens during this specific time period.
Exactly. It's an echo of that question, how long? And Dr. Witter, she points to this as the primary comfort of Daniel 8. Imagine you're Daniel, and you're overwhelmed by this vision, you know, all this darkness and violence, then boom, this promise, evil's on a leash. That's the hope here.
Even in the midst of suffering.
Right. And it's a message that speaks to, I think, anyone who's ever felt like the world is just out of control. There's an appointed end, even if we don't know when or how it's going to come. And that's reinforced when you see how the little horn is finally defeated. He's broken, but by no human hand.
Okay, what does that mean?
It implies divine intervention. It's not human effort or politics or anything like that. It's God stepping in and saying, okay, that's enough.
It must have been powerful for Daniel to receive this vision, you know, especially considering what was happening at the time.
Totally. But even with that reassurance, this vision leaves Daniel shaken. He's overcome, sick for some days.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Like, he can't even process what he's seen.
It shows you these visions, these messages of hope and divine justice. They can be really heavy, you know.
For sure. Daniel's not just watching this stuff from a distance. He's living it. He's invested. And this vision, you know, it doesn't offer the same clear victory as chapter 7.
Right, right.
That image of the Son of Man receiving the everlasting kingdom.
Yeah.
It's not here. The comfort in Daniel 8 is different. It's about endurance. It's knowing that there's a limit to the suffering. Evil's on a leash.
Even if that leash seems pretty long sometimes.
Yeah.
But you mentioned earlier that Dr. Witter sees another layer of comfort here, right? Something about God's suffering alongside humanity.
Oh, yeah. If you look closely, you'll notice that the prince of the host, who represents God, right? He experiences loss, too.
His sanctuary is desecrated, yeah?
Exactly. The daily sacrifices are taken away. It's like God's not detached or indifferent.
He suffers alongside his people.
And that idea is going to be developed even further in the New Testament, you know, with Jesus taking on human flesh, experiencing the full range of human emotions.
Including pain and grief.
Yeah.
Which leads to the big question, right? Why does God allow suffering in the first place? If he's really in control, if he's got evil on a leash, why give it so much slack?
That's the question, isn't it? And there's no easy answer, but maybe part of it has to do with free will. If we're truly free to choose, then evil's always going to be a possibility.
So maybe allowing evil to play out within certain boundaries, it's part of some bigger plan that we just can't see.
I think it's worth considering. We got to remember, we're just human. We've got limited perspectives. God's ways are higher than our ways, you know, like Isaiah said.
So we've covered the historical context, the symbolic imagery, the theological stuff. It's a lot. What does it all mean for us today? Like, how can we apply these ancient visions to our modern lives?
That's the key question, right? I think one of the biggest takeaways is perspective. When we're in the middle of something difficult, it can feel like it'll never end. Like those 2,300 evenings and mornings could go on forever.
Yeah, it's easy to lose sight of the big picture when you're in the thick of it.
But Daniel 8 reminds us that even the worst evils have an expiration date. God's in control. He'll bring justice. And even more importantly, we're not alone in our suffering. God's right there with us.
It's a message of hope, even if it doesn't answer all our questions. But I think there's another takeaway here, and it might be even harder to swallow. This vision forces us to really confront the nature of evil.
Yeah, for sure.
It asks, is evil like a force of its own, or is it ultimately a tool in God's hand?
And if it is a tool, I mean, what is it even for? What's the purpose?
Yeah, it really makes you that. It's not like it's giving us, you know, easy answers. It's more like it's throwing down a challenge, making us wrestle with these mysteries.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about Daniel, especially a chapter like 8. It's not just giving us a pat answer, you know. It's really inviting us to think critically about our faith, about evil, about suffering.
Yeah, it's not just about figuring out what the symbols mean. It's about engaging with these huge existential questions.
Exactly. And remember, we're just scratching the surface here, right? There are so many more layers of meaning, historical connections, theological debates, all within just this one chapter.
It's overwhelming, but like, in a good way. It makes me want to keep digging, you know?
That's the spirit. And, you know, Dr. Witter's lecture, it gives you a really solid foundation for that. But as you go deeper into Daniel 8, there are a couple of key questions to keep in mind.
Oh, I like where this is going. Hit me with those questions. What should I be thinking about?
Okay, so one that really stands out for me is this. Whose transgression are we talking about here? Because that word transgression, it comes up a lot in the chapter, but it's not always clear who's doing the transgressing.
Hmm, yeah. So is it like the little horn? Obviously he's wicked. But is there something even bigger going on here? Like some kind of cosmic rebellion?
Right. And that ties into the whole question of who or what is behind the little horn, right? If it's not just his own power, does that mean there's some other darker force at work? Something even more sinister?
Spooky.
Yeah, it is a bit, isn't it? But these are the kinds of questions that are really worth chewing on, you know? And as you do, think about how this chapter connects to those bigger themes in Daniel. You know, God's sovereignty, the faithfulness of his people, even when things are really bad. And ultimately, that good triumphs over evil.
Yeah, so it's like this one chapter, it's almost like a little version of a whole book. Hits on all those big ideas.
Right. So much to think about. So much to unpack. But hopefully this has given you a good place to start, you know? And more importantly, hopefully it's sparked your curiosity to keep exploring.
Yeah, that's the best part about these old texts, right? They just keep giving you new insights, new challenges. It's a journey.
It really is. And the journey is often just as rewarding as actually figuring it all out, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. So keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deeper. Until next time, happy diving.